And good day to you. Welcome to another edition of The Front Page on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Chuck Mraz. Today we'll be talking about a new book. It's called Almost Anxious. Is my or my loved one's worry or distress a problem? Today, joining us on the front page, one of the authors of this book, Dr. Luana Marcus, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and senior clinical psychologist at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And Dr. Marcus, welcome to the front page. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be here myself. Or here a moment ago, I didn't have any headphones and couldn't hear you. Well, I'll tell you what, it's an interesting book. When we talk about anxiety, it's an issue that just about, I don't know how many Americans suffer from. I guess it's quite a bit, but at the same time, I guess they're different degrees, correct?
Yes, absolutely. It's definitely different degrees. So there are people that really have diagnostic level of anxiety, severe anxiety disorders, and there are folks that are in the middle that's still suffering but might not reach the clinical level. That's what we call almost anxious.
Well, anxiety itself, though, is not necessarily a bad thing. I read that in the book. It can be a good thing.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say it can be a good thing in some ways.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I really emphasize in the book. I think in our society today, anxiety got a bad rap. And in fact, it helps us tremendously up to a point. The example that I use in the book is when you're about to take an exam, for example, if you don't have some level of arousal, some level of anxiety, it's hard to perform. It's hard to stay awake. But a little too much anxiety can then get really in the way and then maybe interfere with your concentration.
It's kind of that fight or flight mode type thing, isn't it?
Yeah, when you get to fight or flight, then you're definitely in a little bit of a trouble, except in situations when you need it, right? So in the book, I try to separate the fight or flight when it's too much anxiety and it's getting in the way versus the fight or flight when you need it. So like if there's a car coming down the street, you better have fight or flight to get out of the way, right? But if it's really sitting and taking an exam, well, you're not going to be able to focus on that. Gets people into trouble.
One thing I found interesting in your book that you mentioned that I guess it's Western society deals more with the problem of anxiety than certain other societies around the world.
That is true. There's definitely different prevalence of different anxiety disorders in different societies, and what's called, you know, anxiety and how it's conceptualized, it's very different. And some of it may be that, you know, we tend to live very fast-paced lives with a lot on our plates, and we emphasize multitasking, which often leads to a lot more anxiety.
We talk about good anxiety and also bad anxiety. At what point does anxiety start to become bad? Because, as you mentioned, anxiety can be a good thing because it can put you, as athletes like to say, in the zone, but at the same time, you can go past that, and then it can become a bad thing.
So it's hard to define precisely. In the book, what we do is we have people fill out a questionnaire. It's only 7 questions. And it asks different domains of anxiety, so parts like worrying and different aspects of anxiety. And the score on that questionnaire is what we use to sort of define almost anxious. But the way I like to explain to my patients is when you notice that consistently you're having trouble because anxiety is interfering with at least one domain of your life. So if it's just a bad day or even a bad week, it may not be so bad as long as the anxiety starts to come down. The problem is when it's in the book, there's a nice little curve, and when you get to the top of that curve and the anxiety starts to affect your performance, starts to really get in the way, and consistently over time, then I think it's time to sort of try to fine-tune and bring it back to the zone.
Is there a point where you get to the top of the zone and then perhaps start to bleed into being too anxious? I know that there have been pro athletes who've had to be treated for anxiety disorders, and these are people that are at the peak of their ability. Obviously, they've handled high-pressure situations before, but at some point or another, they started to lack the ability to handle those situations.
Absolutely. I think the most important thing, I think, to remember about anxiety is that it's a fluid concept, right? You can be doing very okay right now. And let me give you an example. Imagine that right before the show, I had a thought, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to answer a question. I might have bled into a little too much anxiety. And then if I had a thought, oh, well, I've done lots of this, I can handle it, then you might have gone back to the zone. So it really goes in and out in some ways. The question is when it goes out of the zone and then you can't bring it back sort of in a natural process, that's when I think some of the tools in the book are really helpful.
Any idea on your part how many Americans suffer from a full-blown anxiety disorder, something along that line, somewhere? I know there are many different types, but how many in your mind, roughly?
So I think that's a tough question because of exactly what you said. It depends on the anxiety disorder. So some of the prevalence are as low as 2%. Some of them are as high as 8%. So it really depends on which one we're talking about. If it's generalized anxiety disorder versus social phobia, we're conceptualizing almost anxious as one out of four people may fall into that category.
So give us the concept of almost anxious. They're not quite there to be diagnosed with full-blown anxiety issues, but they're kind of, sitting in the gray area, dealing with it a bit.
Yeah, so the way that in psychology, we diagnose somebody is by using the DSM, the diagnostic manual that we use. And that manual is really helpful. And it would say something like, if you worry more days than not for the past 6 months and you have the following symptoms, you may have generalized anxiety disorder. The problem with that manual is that it's like 4 out of 7 symptoms, for example, to meet a diagnostic criteria for generalized anxiety disorder for people that worry. And what happened to the folks that have 3 of those symptoms? They don't meet criteria, but they are still impaired. And there's lots of research that shows that subclinical anxiety can be really impairing and cost people a lot in terms of work productivity and not being able to be on top of their game. And so Almost Anxious is designed for those folks that are not full-blown anxiety disorder, meaning they don't meet the diagnostic criteria, but they're also not in the zone. They are not in on top of their life. So they're in that gray area that really could use some help, but often is not identified, so they don't seek help. I just had a call from somebody last week that read the book and said, you know, I've been in this gray area zone for the last 6 months, and I really thought wasn't much, and the book helped this woman clarify what she could do.
It almost sounds like someone who's trying to climb up the down escalator, and that down escalator is moving rather quickly. They can keep up, but they really can't get over the hump, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. They can keep up, but there is a price tag on keeping up, and often the price tag may not be easy to identify, so they're getting less sleep, they are feeling more tired, but they are like, well, I've been doing a lot, so I'm going to keep at it. And eventually, it really becomes a large price tag. And one day, I think, you know, if you don't have to pay, why go there?
Well, Dr. Marcus, is it just these types of people, they can function day to day. They can get through each day, but, you know, they have to really kind of slog their way through these days. And their anxiety doesn't necessarily prevent them performing, but perhaps prevents them performing at their peak?
That's exactly right. So they are working. They are doing the things they need to do. They are taking care of their kids. But they're struggling to it. And they know. They can tell you, you know what, this is hard. But they keep at it.
You give some examples. I know that you give clinical examples of individuals, and I guess they might be composites of people that you've helped treat before, different types of problems to give people maybe an idea of when we talk about almost anxious, what's that all about, really?
Yeah, we give several examples. So in the book, what I try to do is separate almost anxious in sort of different categories to help people think about their own anxiety. And that's why I separate in the worry type. I separate in the social type and the panic type, the physical sensation, fight or flight, like you described earlier. And in each of those, I give examples of patients that were struggling with it, and they are compositive. They are of the patients I've seen for the past 10 years. So, for example, somebody that would fall into worry type, it's somebody that really stuck on thinking about their thinking. And it's not a specific area, but they're having a lot of negative thoughts or thoughts that worrisome, and they start to have trouble concentrating, sleeping, being able to start having some muscle pain. Some people that worry a lot start feeling aches and their shoulders hurt. And they can describe this, and they know that they are at work, and they're not doing as much or producing as much because of that worry.
You use an interesting term in your book. You call it, I guess, the flavors of anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, I try to sort of think about it as, in some ways, it's hard to separate. It's like a cake. You know, you have all the recipes there, but you could have a chocolate cake. You could have a vanilla cake. You could have a carrot cake. And you need some of the basics. So some of the things, you know, the basic would be the anxiety, the level of anxiety. And then the question is, what is the focus of your anxiety? And so the flavors of almost anxious are the focus of the anxiety. So is it more the worry? Is it more the physical? Is it more social situations? It does not matter that your anxiety is only in, it does not mean that your anxiety is only in one category. It could be that you are almost anxious, mostly worry, but, you know, the worry gets much higher when you are in a social situation because you also have concerns about how people perceive you.
Well, people will often say to defeat your fears, you need to face them. Is that the same thing when we talk about anxiety? Do you have to find a way to face them? I know it's almost impossible for some people to do that.
So it is the concept is to face them. And I think the idea of being impossible, I think we get closer to areas of diagnostic anxiety disorders. So what I try to explain in the book is this idea that often when somebody thinks about facing the anxiety, they think about it black and white. Either they go all the way or they don't do it at all. And much like the optimal anxiety has a category in the zone, when we think about facing our fears, if we do it in a way that's slow and progressive, and what I call in the book being comfortably uncomfortable, so a little out of your comfort zone, but not so much that you feel paralyzed, then most of the people, actually, I think all of the patients I've worked with have been able to do it. It just takes a little practice and a lot of courage.
So you do it kind of in increments, is that correct?
That's correct. We do it gradually. So let me give you a very concrete example. Somebody has a really strong fear of driving, and they now are only driving around the corner to drop their kids on daycare, but they won't go over a bridge. They won't drive in traffic. They won't drive in bad conditions. What we'll do is we'll make what I in the book is called the hierarchy. It's just a list of situations where they would have to drive. We'll ask that person to rate on a 0 to 100 scale of how anxious they would be in those situations. And then we'll pick something around a 40 or 50, something that they feel like they can tolerate, and would practice that over and over again until that really the anxiety came down. And then we'd go to the next thing on that list.
So can you use visualization, I guess, is what I'm trying to say?
Well, there is some research now that uses virtual reality. So not just sitting and visualizing, but actually being in a situation, much like sort of the video game of the world and with some goggles and you're actually driving in the world. If somebody's fear is so severe, that might be a great place to start. The technology has been using now, we have a research study here at MGH that we're doing it for veterans or with post-traumatic stress disorder to get them to habituate to some of the things that happen so that the anxiety is not so high. So definitely you can do it with some visualization. It depends on the condition you're talking about and what kind of resources the person has, because very few places have the virtual reality equipment.
This, in a way, reminds me of back when I was in high school, and when we talk about visualization and using simulation, we used to use driving simulators in a classroom in addition to maybe getting out in the car and actually driving on the highway, and the driving simulators put you in a low-pressure situation where you could deal with things, and, you know, it really, you knew kind of that it wasn't real, but at the same time, you were treating it like the real deal.
That's exactly right. It's a proxy, right? It helps you sort of approximate it as much as you can of the situation. The newer ones really feel very real. The ones that I've seen lately are amazing degree of precision. And it's a step towards that. So the idea is to progress gradually and teach some skills and get somebody to get used to it before they actually get on the road. I think it's a great idea.
Again, the book is Almost Anxious, and Is My or My Loved One's Worry or Distress a Problem? We're talking to one of the authors of the book, Dr. Luana Marcus, and we will do some more of that right after this here on Front Page.
Support for MSPR is provided in part by Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky. With a $6 billion investment in our state and thousands of jobs at its Georgetown plant, plus thousands of additional indirect jobs through parts suppliers and vendors, Toyota is more than an automotive maker. It's an economic engine that drives the Commonwealth. Toyota Kentucky is online at facebook.com/visittoyotaky. Toyota in Kentucky, part of the economy.
Again, we're talking about the book Almost Anxious here on Front Page. Our guest is one of the authors, Dr. Luana Marcus. And Dr. Marcus, as we continue the discussion, when we talk about anxiety, you mentioned in your book some things that also play into perhaps a problem with anxiousness. For instance, diet is one thing I know you discussed, nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you could discuss that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So when often I have patients come in and they talk about their anxiety, and how bad it is, and I'll ask a question, well, when is the last time I ever had a good meal? And they're like, oh, I've been so anxious, I haven't eaten. And we know that eating really is correlated to somebody's level of anxiety to the extent that, you know, your blood sugar changes, and some of the things that you can do is mimic anxiety. So in the book, I try not to touch diet in the sense of, you know, how people define diet today, but really about regular meals and balanced meals so that we can separate that variable out. So somebody can say to me, you know, I ate three times and I had my snacks and I'm still anxious. Okay, so let's deal with anxiety. But I think the three big important things is really eating, sleeping, and exercising. And I emphasize all three of those because through the years, I really learned from my patients that if we get that fine-tuned first, we have a better shot at getting their anxiety to an optimal level faster. And really, that's my goal when I'm working with somebody is really to work myself out of a job so that they can be better. And so I focus on those things in the book a lot.
Well, we know in Western society, particularly here in the U.S., we don't get enough sleep.
That is absolutely true. And the question is, are we willing to pay the price tag of not getting enough sleep? And sometimes do we even have a choice, right? When you have a small child at home, you really may not have a choice. You may be a single parent and you have to just go on with your life. And the question is, what can you do about it? There are ways around it that you could, you know, find a little more sleep, get a little more help. And if not, then we'll deal with the consequence and do the best we can. But most of the time when I work with somebody, they can be creative and they find ways to get a little more sleep maybe so that they are not paying such a high price tag for not sleeping.
So you would agree, I would think, that when you're more tired, you're more susceptible to be anxious, correct?
Absolutely. The moment you're more tired, you know, it's like your body's not functioning its best. And if you have a vulnerability, if anxiety is where you go, then you may just be sitting in your office, and next thing you know, you're feeling really, really anxious. And the thing is, you just haven't slept more than 5 hours for the last 4 weeks. And then your thinking tends to change. And so my experience is patients get more rigid with their thinking. They get more scared, like something bad might happen. But then often a thought that somebody with anxiety may have, and they can't even tell you what it is. It's just that they're really exhausted and they haven't slept much.
And people will often use mild stimulants, if nothing else, to try to get over the fact that they're tired, coffee, for example, or other caffeine products, but sometimes that can maybe also exacerbate the problem, can't it?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think I actually mentioned this in the book, that a cup of coffee in the morning might be the thing that wakes you up fast enough that you're on top of your game and maybe in that zone. But if you're really, really tired and you're not used to having more than a cup of coffee and you have three cups of coffee, well, you're shooting yourself straight into almost anxious territory because then that stimulant is going to get your brain thinking a lot more faster, or it might induce some physical sensation. So I have patients come in and say, you know, my heart was beating so fast I couldn't focus because I was really scared. And it might just be a consequence of a little too much coffee.
You also talk about the need for physical activity, which can help in this situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a tricky one, right? Because it seems to be the thing that falls through the cracks. You might be able to get a little more sleepy. You might be able to get some, you know, a balanced diet. But then exercise seems to really fall through the cracks when people get busy and when life's chaotic, like most of our lives. And the fact is, the exercise will bring your anxiety down. It's a natural remedy for anxiety. And so what I try to do with everybody I work with is really finding creative ways. You know, if you can't put more time in your day, which none of us really can buy time, then can you at least take the stairs up to your office? Can you at least park your car 4 blocks away from the office and walk those 4 blocks each way? Can you at lunchtime do something that is very unmindful that I wouldn't like somebody to do, but that the only way for them to get exercise, get a sandwich and eat it walking around the block so that at least you get out of your chair and get some exercise. Doesn't have to be a lot, but it certainly will help with people's anxiety.
I think it makes a lot of sense, though, in the fact that if you exercise on a regular basis, you're also wearing your body down just a little bit. You're building it up, but you're also wearing it down. So maybe at night you're a little bit more tired and you're a little more relaxed and you're able to sleep better, and that maybe also helps you with your problem with anxiety.
That's so absolutely true. It's that vicious cycle that I'm trying to break. And you just summarize in a beautiful way that by exercising, you do get your body more tired. The more tired you are, you're less likely to actually lay in bed worrying. And so if laying in bed worrying keeps you up and are you not getting enough sleep, if you get some exercise, maybe we can break that cycle and get you to sleep a little better and longer.
Is it also important perhaps to have a support system, say friends and family?
I think I have a whole chapter on that, right? It's really important. When you get to the place that you're almost anxious, then as I mentioned earlier, one of the things that gets really hard is your thinking. You may get a little rigid. And if you have fears, you might really have trouble engaging in life, if you engage at all. And so having a support system, identifying the people that really can help you in different ways and in different areas is really powerful. If, for example, earlier in the show, I gave an example of somebody that has a driving phobia. The first time they drive over a bridge and they're really scared, it's okay to have somebody in the car with them. That might be the only way they can do it. And then after they practice with that person enough, then they can do it by themselves. And so, you know, social support is the stronger predictor of somebody getting better across many of the anxiety disorders. So if you have somebody in your life that you can ask for help, I think you must.
Well, friends and family members can actually help you decompress. You can be who you are and not feel any pressures a lot of times with these people. I guess that's important too, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. They definitely can be a source of support. And like the example of anxiety, exercising that we mentioned a few seconds ago, you know, if your husband can go to the gym with you and can drag you along, that's great. You get time with him and you get exercise. It's really a great idea.
Well, we're just about out of time, Dr. Marcus, but how can people get a copy of your book, Almost Anxious?
They can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of sort of the major sellers.
Well, thanks so much for being with us today on the Front Page. We certainly appreciate your time and wish you the best of luck in your next book, too, as well.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, the book is Almost Anxious. Our guest is Dr. Lana Marcus, who's written this book. Yeah, I'm Chuck Morales, host of the Front Page. We'll see you next time.